Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show with accomplished chess players, authors, personalities, and adult improvers where they discuss their lives, their careers, and share tips about how to improve at chess. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. So without further ado, let's get to it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Chess Books Recaptured. I am excited to talk this month about one of my favorite chess books of all time, I have to say. And for listeners who haven't heard these podcasts before, every month, and we're hopefully getting back to an every month schedule after some delays, we take a break from interviews and review and assess a chess book, try to share some improvement highlights, tell you for what rating level the book might be appropriate, and just overall assess whether a book is worth one's time. And to join me doing it this month, we have a fellow chess podcaster. He is the host of the Chess Journeys podcast, which I always enjoy. It's basically a weekly conversation with a chess improver or not improver, as Kevin will explain. And he is also a dad and a history teacher and an extreme chess enthusiast. So happy to welcome Kevin to Perpetual Chess. Kevin, what's going on?
Thanks so much for having me. This book is both one of my all-time favorites now and a book that was sort of the bane of my existence for years as people kept recommending it and I kept trying it and I couldn't get into it.
Yeah, I mean, there's the constant problem in the chess world of if you ask someone, an experienced chess player, their favorite chess books, they don't necessarily filter for rating. So you probably hear this one a lot because it's such a classic. But honestly, Kevin, you're like 17-something USCF, I believe. And that's about where one should start with this book. I would say maybe 1600, which, you know, for Lee Chess Rapid or whatever, that would be more like 1900 Lee Chess Rapid. That's about where one should start with it. I personally don't think one would be totally lost beneath that, but it's advanced concepts. I mean, all the games obviously are won not by someone hanging a piece or falling for a basic tactic. There are these beautiful grinds. So what were your early, less positive experiences with the book, Kevin?
Yeah, so I remember I was looking to figure out endgames. I knew nothing. And people were like, you should read Endgame Strategy. And this was a time when I did not know what the term opposition was. And I was like, okay, this is the book to teach me endgames. Right. And I read the first chapter, which is called something like Endgame Principles. And it gives you no principles for the endgame. All it tells you is, end games are different. And I was like, what is happening? And I finished the whole chapter. I learned nothing about end game principles or the basics of end games and was very confused and said, I don't know what is happening with people recommending this book, but this book is not for me. And I tried it, you know, about three different times at different points in my journey, each time forgetting that first chapter and then being completely turned off by that first chapter. Do you remember that chapter and how empty it is of chess principles? It was really disconcerting.
Yeah, for me, it's a different experience. I was trying to think back in our discussion prior to recording of what rating I was when I first read this, but I would guess I was at least 1800. And I just loved it from the start. And as I reread it, there are a few flaws with the book, which we'll discuss, but But even rereading it all these years later, I still loved it. So yeah, I think a lot of it just comes down to your chess experience. So to build on what you said, Kevin, for anyone listening, I would say make sure you've read like up to the 1600 or 1800 level of Silman's Endgame Manual, for example. Certainly you want to be familiar with concepts like opposition or the Lucina position, the bridge position in rook and pawn endgames, the Philidor position. You don't need to know them cold, but you should at least know what they are before you consider a book like this. You know, 100 endgames you must know obviously gets name checked a lot here, and it's a great course, but you don't need to complete that. It's more like, you know, the basics, you know what opposition is, you know what distant opposition is, and you're rated again, I think ideally around 1600 tournament chess. And then it's a fantastic book. But before then, you might have an experience like Kevin did where it's counterproductive. What other endgame stuff had you done, Kevin? I guess not much, it sounds like.
Yeah, but before I had done nothing. And then I realized this book was not for me. And like you just said, I read Silman's complete endgame course up to about 1600, 1800. And what I realized is what I now have are some cool building blocks. I know opposition. If we randomly get a Philidor, I'm in business. But as we transition to the endgame, I had no idea how to like actually play an endgame. I just had a couple building blocks that I could slot in if they happened to come up.
Yeah, and that's one thing about these technical endgame books. I call the ones that tell you how to play a certain position technical. I'm not the only one who calls them this, but just for the sake of clarity. But these technical endgame positions, I mean, you can drill them and drill them and drill them, but then when you get them on the game, you need to be able to identify them in the moment. And that is like degrees of difficulty harder. So that's one reason that I often end up advocating for books like this, such as Endgame Strategy. Of course, the other one that I mention all the time is Capablanca's Best Chess Endings by Irving Chernev. Absolute classic with a sort of similar spirit. But there aren't that many like that, right? Kevin, you've been saying that this book struck you as very unique.
Yeah, definitely. I've looked at so many endgame books in this, trying to figure out just what to do. So the next step was, okay, I've read a bunch of Silman. He's very confident that I should be good at endgames now, and I'm not. So then I'm going to read 100 Endgames You Must Know. And that was like this massively overwhelming experience. It was like 1,000 Endgames You Must Know. And they didn't feel like endgames I had to know to have the basics. It felt like really advanced stuff very quickly. And as I'm going into these deep rook pawn endgames, I still have in the back of my head, but Kevin, you have no idea how to play endgames, right? Like there's 8 pawns on the board, 2 rooks, and each side has a knight. What do? It's not in this 100 endgames you must know. And I had no idea where to even begin. You know what I would do usually, Ben? I'd do this.
What's up?
I heard you're supposed to bring the king to the center. And I would just start aimlessly moving my king to the center because that was the one principle I knew.
Okay, well, yeah, and this book is chock full of little mantras and principles, and he does a nice job repeating them. So hopefully you feel a little bit less lost now, Kevin.
Yeah, I'm going to go so far as to say this book has transformed completely how I even play chess, right? So not only has it given me ideas of how to play the endgame, some principles of how to play the endgame, but then those have trickled down to my middle game play. As before, I knew like, hey, you don't want to have double pawns going into the end game. That would be bad. And I would think, sure, that totally makes sense. And then I would get to an end game and go, I don't know like how this works or how I'm supposed to exploit this. But now, even from the early middle game, anytime I can make a weakness, I'm thinking, ooh, I've made 3 weaknesses already. If I could turn this into an end game, I would be in business. Or conversely, if I have a bunch of weaknesses, now I'm thinking, oh, I got to do something big in the middle game, because if we go to an end game and my situation looks like this, I'm in huge trouble. And now compare that to before, when we get to an end game and I would just go, king goes to the center? Like these are, you know, earth-shattering differences here.
Yeah, and he does define the concept of a weakness, because I think everyone can identify a weak pawn, you know, double isolated pawns, doubled pawns, backward pawns, isolated pawns, etc. But he... I'm sure we'll get to the principle of 2 weaknesses. One of his many sort of prevailing themes of the book, but he also defines a weakness as it can, he says, I quote, it can be much wider than a lone pawn, which can be subject to attack. It can be the occupation of an open file, an enemy outside pass pawn. That means one on your team, an immobile piece, a king, which is cut off, and so on. So for one thing, this broader definition of weaknesses, I think probably you did. And I do find helpful.
Yeah. It's so fascinating too, because I'm still not a great chess player, right? And so he shows a position and I look at it. I'm like, okay, there's a weakness here. I can see that this backwards pawn is what we're attacking. But then as the game develops, it's very clear that it is not enough for them just to have that one weakness. And it's always fascinating to me how he shows how this other weakness gets created, which often still seems to me almost by magic, right? It's like your pawns are perfect. But when you attack it with this bishop and then you reroute the knight over here and then you blind your opponent with some waiting moves for a few moves to lull them into a false sense of security, then you strike and you make the second weakness. And it's just like mind blowing sometimes.
Yeah. So probably self-evident. That's what the principle of two weaknesses mean. Often one weakness is not enough. And if you think about like military strategy or a board game like Risk, you know, that's often a concept that comes up in those. I mean, if you're just like, even if you have in Risk, like an army game, if you have the army dwindled, but they're hunkered down, it's tough to crack them. But, and similarly, it's like attacking from different flanks in a battle. So it makes sense, but again, it's the fact that they give it a language. You know, I don't know to what extent he deserves the full credit. We'll get into that when we dive a little deeper into the background. But there's like a big Alekhine quote, this beautiful endgame that Alekhine plays, where he has a quote from, I guess, Alekhine, excuse me, where Alekhine breaks down his strategy in full. And then Shereshevsky jumps in and says, like, oh, and by the way, that was the principle of two weaknesses. And you're like, oh, yeah, that was the principle of two weaknesses. Mm-hmm. But until you're thinking, until you have the language, it can be hard to implement the strategy. So I think, are you finding that helpful in terms of like forming a plan when you play now, Kevin?
Oh yeah, well, definitely. I mean, just even the idea of formulating a plan is transformative for me right now. When I enter an end game, I try to stop myself and say, what is your plan here? You're no longer playing the same chess game you were. What's your plan? And that's what I'm thinking. Where are the weaknesses? How many are there? If there's only one, that's not enough. Whereas before, I would have assumed one would easily be enough. I have the open file. Boom, I'm going to win this. But now I'm thinking that's not enough. And I'm trying to figure out if there's not another weakness, where can I create one? What can I do to make my opponent's position vulnerable? And I'm doing that right from the first moment the endgame starts, instead of kind of letting it develop. And then going, wait, we should probably figure out what to do here.
Yeah. I mean, here's the quote from Alekhine, which I think is representative of a lot of the sort of end games you see in this. And obviously, again, if you study someone like Capablanca or Rubinstein's games, you'll see these sort of plans in action. But he says, the play in the ending is by no means so simple as it appears, especially for Black's plan, which will prove completely successful. It consists of the following parts. One, exchange one pair of books. Rooks, excuse me. Two, transfer the king to e6, where it will be defended by the e-pawn and can prevent the invasion of the enemy rook. Three, operate with the rook on the g-file and advance the h-pawn. So that's what Kevin was saying about where you're creating the weakness. Four, after this, White's king and possibly his bishop will be tied to the defense against the invasion of the rooks. Black, meanwhile, five, by advancing his A and B pawns, will sooner or later also have open files on the queen side. Six, since at this point, since the king will still be on the opposite wing, White should be able to prevent the invasion of the first or second rank. And then he goes on to say, it must be admitted that had White from the beginning realized there was a real danger of him losing this ending by careful defense, he might have been able to save the king. But what happened was that Black played according to a definite plan, whereas White played only with the conviction that the game was bound to end in a draw. The result was an instructive series of typical patterns and stratagems, much more useful to students of the game than so-called brilliancies of short one-sided games. And there's just lots of examples like that. I mean, obviously, when you see it, it's more powerful. But to have a six-prong plan, like, it's amazing. And they make it look easy. So, I mean, I'm a bit higher rated than you, Kevin, but I'm still not at a level where, like, I'm routinely kind of pulling off that mm-hmm. that sort of trick. But it's just such a pleasure to play through and to learn from.
Yeah, and I have found myself doing things like that now. They don't always work out because I can't see everything as clearly. But going into an end game, I'm trying to do that. I'll say, okay, step one, I'm going to take this open file. Step two, they have a bishop that's going to be a bad bishop and a good bishop, and I have a good bishop and a knight. I'm going to try to trade the good bishops by going here, leaving them with a bad bishop. And then, you know, my king is closer to the center, and I can do this thing. And half the time, by the way, I'm wrong, and it all collapses and falls apart. But I'm trying to emulate that in my games, and it's really been helpful.
That's
according to the only metric I have for this, which is unfortunate. By the way, any programmers out there, make like a chess.com puzzles thing, but for end games. But I am using Aim Chess, and a month ago it said you lose all your end games. Winning, even, or losing, when you enter the end game, you basically lose them all. And now, if I'm winning or even equal, I win almost every end game. So it's been this just huge transformation for how my end game play has worked. Now, when I'm losing, I still lose every game. I don't know what's going on there. That's another story.
Okay, that'll be in the next book, I guess. But yeah, I mean, that's great to hear. And, you know, another concept that comes up sort of inextricably linked to the idea of the principle of two weaknesses and hearing a plan like that of six phases is the other primary mantra, I would say, which is do not hurry, which is just this beautiful idea that, you know, I mean, obviously, if you play through the games of a Paul Morphy or, you know, trace the development of chess, the beginning of the game is a sprint. You know, if you don't get your pieces out, you're in trouble. But in the end games, I mean, if you get to a discussion of sort of static versus dynamic weaknesses, the contours have been defined in the position, and often the weaknesses that your opponent has will be of a static nature. So you kind of have to shift your mindset from playing for a race to like making sure everything's perfect, you know. And there's the examples from like Ulf Anderson and Rubinstein, and they just make sure before they implement their like multi-step plan, they just make sure every piece is where they want it, because often they have an advantage such that their opponent can't do the same thing. So it's another sort of prevailing theme that makes the games super instructive to play through.
Yeah, and it's what I'm worst at by far. That is such a hard concept to get. Do not hurry. It's like, what are you talking about? Like, yeah, no. I know you have a plan and it's a good plan, but, you know, don't enact it yet, because you can slightly improve your position and your opponent can't do anything. And you're going, okay. So every time I try to do that, I look at the board and I go, my opponent can do nothing. I'm going to do this little waiting move thing to improve my position slightly. And my opponent goes, really? I can do nothing? I think right. You are mistaken on that one, sir. And then they crush me.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a tension, you know, what you mentioned, Kevin, about racing your king to the center of the board. Often that's going to be a correct strategy. And in that, like, you know, your king's basically trying to stake out some territory. So, you know, whoever gets to midfield first might have an advantage. So in that case, you kind of do have to hurry. But it's more like when everything else is defined, then you see these great players are amazing at really making sure everything is lined up before they go on to the next multi-step or the next phase of their multi-step plan. So Kevin, I want to take a break and hear from our sponsors. You already mentioned our friends at Aim Chess, which of course you can use the code perpetual30 if you sub, but what else can you use, Kevin?
That's it. That's the only code you should use.
No, it's great that they also sponsor Chess Journeys, which I always enjoy listening to. So let's take it to a break and then we'll be back in a minute. Listeners, our friends at aimchess.com have a fun new feature that I want to tell you about. It is called the Aim Chess Recap. If you're familiar with Spotify Wrapped, it's basically the chess version of that, your chess year in review. They have a new design to make the user experience more fun, and they tell you all kinds of stats from your year, the ones you might be used to, like how you do with certain openings, certain colors, against who you played the most, how many minutes you played the total year, and then some fun stuff like the total amount of smothered mates you played, the number of en passants taken, all of your missed mate and ones. Okay, maybe that one's not as fun. And if you see something you want to share, you can easily share it on social media. So that's called the AIM Chess Recap. Link is in the show description. It's free to check out. And then if you do decide to subscribe to AIM Chess, use the code PERPETUAL30 to save 30%. All right, let's head back to Perpetual Chess.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
And we are back. And I didn't even say the name of the author yet, which is a bit of an oversight. So, of course, it's Mikhail Sharashevsky, Belarusian chess master and trainer. Last I saw, he's now based in Bulgaria, mentored by Boleslavsky, one of these sort of OG Soviet type players. But and he's written a couple other books as well. This book was originally published in the USSR in 1981, translated to English in 1985. Got a nice foreword from Yusupov. But the provenance of this book is slightly unknown, I would say. I mean, obviously, he was a trainer, an amazing trainer. He had a compilation of positions. But doing all the research that I tend to do for these book recaps, it seems some people have said it was like he and his colleagues compiled this material together. I found a discussion on the Chess Book Collectors Facebook group where GM Jakub Agard of Quality Chess Books, who obviously knows his stuff, was saying the original book by Sharashevsky was based on, a lecture series by Mark Dvoretsky in the mid-1970s. Sharashevsky asked for permission, so it's good that he used the material. But he's saying it's from Dvoretsky's material. Again, take that for what it's worth. I don't know its provenance, but I will say, like, you know, this came from the Soviet Union. There was a very obviously collective mindset, and there were chess trainers everywhere, and it was being, you know, the materials were being sort of disseminated from the top down. So Sharashevsky's name is on the book, but he probably wasn't the only one who contributed to this, but it's not super important anyway. The important thing is that the material is amazing. And we should say it's translated by Ken Neat, legendary translator, and the prose is beautiful. So obviously he deserves some credit as well. Did you enjoy the writing in the book, Kevin?
Yeah, I found it to be clear and precise. You already quoted one of the people he quotes, and I think it's really important where he does that occasionally, where he'll say, we're actually going to use the analysis of this person here, because they've done a great job, and then he'll supplement it a bit. There isn't a lot of extraneous stuff. Like, it doesn't remind me of my system at all, where, you know, it's kind of like, I'm going to throw in this random allusion that's going to make no sense in 100 years from now. It all feels timely. Like, if you told me it was written last week, I would believe that.
Yeah, there's one exception to that, which I have to say, Kevin, I didn't catch this the first time I read this book. I don't know exactly what I was rated or what year it was, but I remember it was revelatory. But this time, the only ebook right now that I could find is on Kindle, and I already had a paper copy, so I just rolled with that. So there's no move trainer type way to play through it that I could find, but there are Lee chess studies. Nothing that I could find that was 100% comprehensive, but if you Google a given game so that you can read through the book and play through it on your device, there's a good chance you'll find it in chessgames.com or you'll find it already in Lee chess. I put up some chunks myself on Lee chess and the stuff that I was working through. But anyway, looking at it this way, what that meant is I had the engine on. And Kevin, man, are there a lot of errors in this book. I wouldn't, of course, now, obviously, full caveat, if I didn't have the engine on, I would have caught like maybe 5% of them if I'm lucky, you know. But when you have the engine on, a lot of the time it's kind of just like mocking some of the analysis. Now, the good news is our friends at New In Chess / Chessable have a new version coming out in May. fully updated additional material. There's going to be a video version. And I only found this out after Kevin and I agreed to do this and then reached out to them to get a few more details. And yeah, so it sounds amazing. So, I mean, anyone in the proper rating range listening to this, full-throated recommendation for this book. But if I were you, I would wait till May before picking it up, because it'll probably be on the new in-chest reader, if you prefer to just read it as a book with the sort of playthrough option, or of course on Chessable or Video Chessable, which obviously could be amazing. So that's something to look forward to. But yeah, it has to be said, tons of engine errors in this. Tons of errors that the engine spotted in the analysis.
I kind of feel like a little kid and you just told me Santa isn't real.
I wish you
hadn't, first of all. Second of all, I'm devastated. Now, for me, what's interesting is it's not about the engine analysis, right? It's
exactly
really just about the ideas and the concepts. I actually don't really care if the precise moments are wrong, but I feel like it's the overall ideas that I'm taking away. That is really interesting, though. I will say this, though. One of the things I love so much about this book is the length. And while new material sounds wonderful, I love the idea that it's something like 211 pages and feels manageable from the first time you pick it up. Whenever I look at something like Dvoretsky's manual, I just look at it and go, no, I'm not doing that. That's it's too big. It's too long. I won't be able to make my way through it. Whereas Endgame Strategy just feels so manageable. You hold it in your little hands and you're like, ooh, it's just the right size. It's not that big. I can make it through this thing.
Yeah, it's not quite on the simple chess scale of like you know, you learned something and you finished the book and you banged it out in 2 weeks. I mean, obviously, I do this every month. And for me, I did about 20 pages a day over a 10-day sprint. And, you know, that's with days off when I was playing a tournament and stuff like that sprinkled in. But I would say that's not optimal, like probably optimal. But again, I had already read this book. I would say optimal, but you could do it 45 minutes a day for 10 days and you'd get great benefit. And then Kevin, as I know you're planning, then you could do it again, right?
Yeah. So I started this book for real December 4th. I've done it every day since then. And I'm only at page 185. Don't worry, listeners. I skimmed the rest of it just to make sure there were no surprises. And I have done a total of 24 and a half hours so far. So I'm really taking my time. It takes me about 15 minutes to play through each game. And I'm trying to do it in this take 2 to 3 months. And that way it really filters in. I feel like when I read a book in a week or two, it comes and it's gone. But when I'm in it and simmering in it and stewing in it for 2 or 3 months, it really seeps in a lot more than the quick sprint does. At least that's been my own process.
Yeah, that makes sense. And to circle back to what you were saying about the engine stuff not being important, Kevin, I agree, full stop. The only caveat I wanted to add was like, sometimes there's like a transition to a king and pawn endgame. And like, you know, as any chess teacher will tell their student, like when there's a transition to a simplified situation like that, that's when like the result could very easily swing. And there was one or two examples where he gets those wrong. So, you know, hopefully you'll get, but then there was also like, there's this queen and pawn ending in the game, like Golden Kurzabov, where you have to do this like 5-move maneuver to basically lose a tempo in order to sacrifice a queen under more favorable circumstances. And he like crushes that analysis. He has it perfect. So there is some really impressive analysis in this. It's just inevitable with any old book that there would be mistakes. And as Kevin says, that's not really what this book is about. It's about how to implement a plan. Plus, if you all wait till May, you'll get the newer version. Anyway, so
it's interesting.
So what else do we have to say about this book, Kevin?
Well, real quick about the engine stuff. I'm doing it as kind of a guessier move for the side that's going to win. And I'm usually wrong. And now I have in the back of my head, am I usually wrong, Shereshevsky?
Right, yeah, you were right every time.
Or have I been right all this time? And I'm the superior endgame player.
Yeah, and the other thing is, like, I'm using the web engine on LeeChess, which is pretty good, but you're not running it at, like, a huge depth. So there was also one or two cases where the engine was initially wrong, and then you play through the I mean, sorry, the analysis was initially wrong, but then if you play through the analysis, the engine is the one that flips. Ooh. So the plot thickens, you know. Yeah. you have to be careful, and certainly can't be too judgmental. Again, that's not the primary thrust of the book, but definitely looking forward to the expanded and updated variation, and Shereshevsky himself will be working on it. So should be exciting.
That's amazing. For some reason, I just assumed Shereshevsky was no longer an active or potentially alive person, because I hadn't seen anything from this individual. So this is really exciting. I wonder if there's a bunch of other works that he's, you know, considering releasing that maybe were only in Russia or only in his files, and he's thinking, ooh, maybe I should release this as well. So, you know, anyone who knows him, let him know. We want all of his stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Chessable people obviously know him, so he's not so unreachable. Maybe he'll be on a Perpetual Chess or Chess Journeys. I don't know how his English is. Obviously, the book was originally written in Russian. But yeah, I mean, there isn't that much online from him. He's an untitled player, and from what I'd read, he is like 22 something FIDE, so obviously a very good player, but from what I read, he did spend some years away from chess. I mean, he moved to Bulgaria and worked in it's a business. So who knows what that means, but apparently he's doing more chess stuff again now. So yeah, I mean, hopefully the more we hear from him, the better, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, this is definitely a first ballot Hall of Fame chess book, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff to hear that there's a new version coming out. He's still involved. Like these are all new twists and turns that I was unaware of.
Yeah, it's amazing for how well known this book is, how little information is available online, and of course that means you can't believe everything you read when it's not from like 10 different sources. So
Ben, I'm gonna tell you a rumor I heard. I right. wrote this book 30 right. years ago.
Yeah, it looks like he's 71 years of age, if I found the correct FIDE page. All right, well, we're going to take one more break, and then we're going to get into some of our favorite and the few least favorite things from this book. Perpetual Chess is proud, as always, to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Of course, Chessable is constantly dropping new courses. Some of their latest include Keep It Simple for Black by I.M. Christoph Selecki, a.k.a. Chess Explained. It gives an entire repertoire for Black, no matter what you face, and Christoph is always thorough, yet not overloading you with variations. There is also a brand new Lifetime Repertoires Berlin Defense from former U.S. champion GM Sam Shanklin. I hate playing against the Berlin, so I'd rather you not get that one. But hey, if you're looking to learn it, of course, Sam Shanklin does not mess around with his course offerings. And of course, whatever you choose to study on Chessable, you can utilize their proprietary Move Trainer technology to help you remember the lines you learn. So be sure, as always, to go to Chessable.com and take a look at what's new. And we are back. And before we dive into the favorites, I did just want to read the names of the 13 chapters just to give listeners a little concept of sort of the type of material you would be dealing with, and then we can pivot from there to which ones we like the best. So here are the 13 chapters: basic principles of endgame play, centralization of the king, the role of pawns in the endgame, the problem of exchanging, do not hurry, schematic thinking, the principle of two weaknesses, the struggle for the initiative, suppressing the opponent's counterplay, positions with an isolated d-pawn, the two bishops, the 3-2 queenside pawn majority, and complex endings, which is where everything else that couldn't fit anywhere else.
Yeah, goes. That should be called miscellaneous.
Yeah, exactly. So what's your favorite, Kevin?
Okay, so my favorite by far, and there are many good chapters, is schematic thinking. That you read a quote already from that chapter. And that's the chapter I feel like that does the best job of really laying out how you should think about endgames sort of in its entirety. Not all endgames are as simple as that, where you can just, from the moment the endgame starts, isolate 6 mini plans that you should be enacting, and with a goal of how you're going to string them together. But after reading that chapter, that is where it all really clicks for me, that endgames are different. And the second we enter an endgame, I should be thinking about what my plans are. I shouldn't just be thinking about centralizing my king. I shouldn't just be thinking about a weakness. I shouldn't just be thinking about that isolated D pawn, but I should be have a master plan that I am working with if I want to win this endgame. And that was amazing. And like that quote you read, there's about five others like that in there where he lists step one, step two, step three. And I couldn't understand all those steps, you know, but I knew they were there and that this is what separates me from someone who can really understand an endgame, that they have a master plan in mind. And that was really a big moment for me.
Yeah, it's amazing to see. It is kind of like a magic trick when you see it in action. Yeah. And yeah, again, my plans don't run as smoothly, although certainly I've benefited from this and tried to create a second weakness and even sometimes succeeded. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing to behold the true masters in action in these end games. Yeah, and that's one of my favorites as well, Kevin. I mean, I don't have any super original choices. I mean, my three favorite chapters are the ones you just mentioned, The Principle of Two Weaknesses and Do Not Hurry, all of which we've already talked about. But those are sort of like, you know, those are just like, if you do some sort of word association with those, with this book, those obviously come to the fore. I mean, the one other one that I thought that was really good is the chapter, the Problem of Exchanging, where he identifies like when you're trying to decide about a certain minor piece exchange or when you should trade rooks, and sort of gives you some guidelines and some amazing examples of good bishops versus bad bishops and bishops versus knights. And overall, I would say this book, again, might have been mildly ahead of its time, although certainly theory was, like chess knowledge was trending in the direction of favoring the bishop versus the knight. But overall, there's one or two examples of the knights reigning supreme, but it's pretty much an ode to the bishop as well, I would say.
Yeah, that chapter, The Two Bishops, has just convinced me that in every endgame, bishops are better. And whenever I enter an endgame and my opponent has two bishops, I'm now terrified. I'm like, well, I'm dead. There are no examples where the bishops don't win.
Yeah.
Because there is no even closed positions. And you're like, there's no way the bishops are better here. And he's like, watch this. You open up the position ever so slightly. Now the bishops crush everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. The bishops are a strong piece. So I think there is at least one example where the knights win. It's obviously same side of the board pawn situation, but yeah, it's the bishop is not to be trifled with.
Yeah. It's funny because for me, one of my least favorite chapters is The Problem of Exchanging. And I think this reflects our rating difference, because what I got out of that chapter was it is nearly impossible to know when to exchange. Grandmasters often get it wrong. You, Mr. 1600, have no chance of getting this right. Also, I'm going to give you almost no principles about when you should do it. I'm just going to give you examples and hope that you can extract the principles from those examples. That was my experience with the chapter.
That's a really good point. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, and again, I think part of it is like, I don't know, when I read this, obviously I'm hoping to get better at chess, as we all are, but it was more just like for enjoyment. So I love the examples. There's so many classic games, you know, not just in the Problem of Exchanging chapters, but like Capablanca Alekhine, Fischer Reshevsky. There's lots of games from Zurich 1953, which I of course did a podcast with Nate Solon on, Karpov Hort. There's just tons of sort of very famous endgames. So for me, it's like a beautiful compilation. So I agree with you that like maybe if you're looking for something strictly prescriptive, then that I could see how that would be a little frustrating. But it also, as you say, it could be a level difference where I don't need as much explain. Maybe I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that's another interesting thing about this book that I feel like on its own, you know, 2000, this might be the only book they need. Someone like me, as I'm reading this, I'm constantly thinking, could you provide a general rule? I would love a bullet point here. This is the takeaway from this game. This is the rule that I'm showing, but they're much broader than that, right? It's more just, here's the principle of two weaknesses. I'm not now going to give you a list of how to do each of these weaknesses and walk you through it step by step, I'm going to show you an awesome game and you will glean that information.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is just the harsh truth that the chess is only so bullet pointable, you know? I mean, the literature has improved a lot in terms of distilling lessons as best as possible. But hey, I mean, there's a reason it's been around for 1600 years and people are still obsessed with it. It's a complex game, but I get what you're saying. I mean, you're looking, you know, you want a good bang for your buck on the time that you spend studying. And if there's not like a, you know, a sentence that you can just take away and try to apply, it can be challenging. But I you know, sometimes there's like an osmosis type process that can happen with chess improvement too. So I think as long as you're fully engaged when you're playing through the games, even if you can't summarize what you just learned completely, I think that there is an inherent benefit to playing through some of these masterful endgames.
Yeah, I've really been wrestling with this book in particular as the example of, is it better to have spoon-fed, bullet-pointed examples that are kind of fake, to be honest, because chess doesn't work like that. You can only trick yourself into thinking it works like that. Or is it better just to have someone give you a broader topic and then just annotate it and show you how that topic works in practice and how it goes in a bunch of different directions, and sometimes it conflicts itself because that's how chess works. So it has been interesting to try to balance that for myself. What is the better approach? And I don't know, but all I know is after playing Shereshevsky, well, going through the book very actively, I feel better. Just little things, where to put my rooks. There's this weird thing, well, weird for me, of sliding the rook behind the king and have like a knight supporting that square and checking. And it doesn't look like it does that much, but it just kind of pushes the king over. And I had never done that check before. And after seeing that happen 50 times in this book, when I see it in games, I just go, I can't know that this is right, but GMs do this all the time, so I'll do it. And it just often does something good for me. And it's just that osmosis thing, right? I don't fully understand it. I just know this is a reasonable move in this position.
Yeah, the weakness of the cutoff king, as mentioned earlier. And yeah. Kevin, hearing you talk about it, I mean, I hear a lot of self-doubt, which I think is natural. I mean, I had an endgame a couple months ago where I had an exchange. I was down an exchange, but I had two pawns for it. And I was the one who could press for the win. And it was a tournament game, so you have a reasonable amount of time to think. But I remember seeing the position and thinking, man, if I were Capablanca, I would have it all mapped out. You know? Uh-huh. I would know exactly what's going to happen from here. But instead, it's like my five stage plan is two stages if I'm lucky. But I was like, all right, well, I have a plan and like I'll do these two stages and maybe he'll screw up. And he did. So it worked out in that case. But yeah, it doesn't always go as smoothly. But the point is you're moving in the right direction, mm-hmm. you know. Every little bit helps, and you kind of have to fake it till you make it. So, you know, if it gives you a bit more confidence, that can become kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of that's the whole bad plan is better than no plan thing.
And my confidence in endgames has just soared, right? It went from zero, I would rather just not play an endgame, to let's do this. Let's trade to the endgame. I've read Shereshevsky. Have you? And so that feels really good to have that thought going in. Now, again, that's online against other 1600s. It'll probably be different when I'm, you know, back at a USCF tournament playing a 1900. And their answer is, yes, I have actually. And I understood it better than you did. I'm like, okay. So it'll be.
I mean, and the book is beautifully instructive. And actually, like, hearing you talk about that, calls to mind during the World Championship, you know, Fabiano did an amazing job with the team at chess.com. And there was one quote that he said that ended up getting clipped and being shared on Twitter and stuff. But he was talking about the evolution in his game in the past few years. And he said, even prior to the World Championship, he generally felt like at the margins, he was trying to avoid end games because he's known as a very concrete player. He has amazing opening preparation and he's one of the best calculating players in the world. He's not known as much for like his delicacy, you know, his subtlety in the way that he plays. But he said he did a lot of work on his endgames, and he said prior to doing that, he felt like his advantage was diminished as you went to an endgame. But after doing the work, he felt like it's actually the complete opposite, that the fewer the pieces on the board, the greater the advantage of the stronger player. And obviously that's something that Magnus has embodied in his career. So to hear that at someone who's already, you know, obviously one of the best players in the world, really, really shines a light on just how much you can learn from the end game. And obviously, for any listeners who didn't hear my interview with Grandmaster Keith Arkell, lower level grandmaster, but has specialized in end games from the beginning and sort of built a career out of knowing his structures and, you know, eagerly trading queens and then just knowing he's going to beat whatever, you know, 2000 to 2300 player in his sleep once things are in an end game. So that, yeah, there's a wide runway in front of you, Kevin.
It just long feels runway, like, I should say. Also, end games are so knowable. Middle games are this impossible mess that you're hoping to wrap your hands around with experience and understanding structures. But once there's less pieces on the board, I don't know. I just feel like theoretically I should be able to figure it out more easily.
Yeah.
And I know it's not necessarily true, but I'm trying.
Yeah, it's definitely not true. I mean, even again, with the engine bar, when you watch the top games, I mean, even the elite players are making mistakes all the time. It's a dark art, but there's real subtlety and, real edges to be gained. We have a quote here from Fred Wilson. Again, I am now naming you Fred, the official book correspondent. Of course, you guys should, if you're in New York City, if you're passing through, go visit Fred Wilson Books near Union Square. He's got a great collection. I think he'll also be at Amateur Team East as the bookseller. So if anyone's there, go say hi to Fred. But anyway, Kevin had been talking about the unique nature of this book and that most endgame books were, he considered to be, again, more technical. And that got me thinking about like what analogs there were to this. And I felt at first like there were a ton of them. But then when I started thinking about it, and then researching it, I realized there aren't that many. And that was when I realized I needed to appeal to a higher authority like Fred. So, of course, there's again, Capablanca's Endings by Chernev, which I would say is a similar level, as Fred points out. But there's not that much else. Anyway, here is Fred's quote. He says, "The only other endgame books, which we would call practical endgames, I can think of from that period is Practical Endgame Lessons by GM Edmar Medness. It was later slightly revised and corrected by Colin Crouch and reissued in 1992 as being by both of them. Medness also wrote several popular and very good shorter books published by Chess Enterprises during this time on Rook, Bishop, Knight, Practical Endgames. He and Benko were the main American writers at this time. While I'm at it, Sharashevsky certainly beat into my brain the concept of do not hurry, although certainly Kara's talked about this much earlier in the Endgame article, The Art of the Middle Game." So some good insights from Fred there. Yeah, and again, that gets to what we were saying about none of this stuff was 100% original likely, but in terms of like a distillation and compilation, it doesn't get much better than this. And by the way, Kevin, I know that you've been also working on the Chessable course, Timeless Techniques. Could you share a little bit about what your experience with that has been?
Yeah, I found that to be a fantastic course that pretty much mirrors this book, but does provide sort of that bullet point information that I'm looking for. And so I really feel like these are great works to read together. I do this weird thing where I have one set of study time where I'm at a board with a book, and that was Endgame Strategy. And then when I would go to bed at night, that's I have Chessable or Forward Chess or something as I'm laying in bed for a half hour. So I would do Sharashevsky during the day, and then I would kind of cement it at night laying in my bed with Timeless Technique. I would do that same section, get a couple more bullet points. And so I'm getting these amazing annotations from Endgame Strategy and then cementing with Timeless Technique. So it's kind of interesting for me because these two books sometimes blend together in my head and I have to really figure out where they're separate. But yeah, I can't recommend that course enough. It's amazing. It gives you you know, that chessable puzzle thing where, you know, you go through the game and then they'll say, okay, remember that game you just looked at? Why, what did they do here? Right. This was the critical moment. What was the reason they did this and what they do? And it was always embarrassing when I couldn't remember that move of the game I just looked at. But oftentimes I could get it. The funny thing, though, is I just clicked the review button because I finished the course and I didn't get any of them right. I missed like 28 in a row. And I'm going, okay, I don't know what's going on here. So I don't know what that means, Ben. Do I have to reread this whole course or can I just accept that a random question taking wildly out of context I'm not able to find the answer to?
No one knows, Kevin. We're all just making it up. So. but yeah, I've read some of Timeless Technique, Red/, I know it's available in video as well by Grandmaster Sahaj Grover and FM Daniel Barish. And yeah, it's a great chessable version of endgame strategy. And of course, endgame strategy, I mentioned there are a lot of classic games, but you could consider that a weakness or a strength, depending on how many times you've seen a bunch of these positions. Whereas Timeless Technique being a modern work, you know, there's examples from Magnus and so on. So lots of modern examples. So if endgame strategy will be on Chessable as well. But if you can't wait to get some endgame work in, Timeless Technique, I would say it's a similar target rating range, like you best suited probably to 1600 to 2200 ish, but every bit as instructive. So definitely give that a shout out as well.
Yeah. I'd say it's a little bit more accessible because of the bullet points. You can trick yourself easier into thinking you're understanding the material than you can with Shereshevsky.
Okay. Well, there's no greater endorsement than we could hope for than that. Okay. Least favorite things. Did we cover that, Kevin?
I do have one thing that I noticed. Okay. So a couple things. The first one is what I've already talked about. My brain and the way I work as an academic is I love having bullet point takeaways. It's what I loved about Shanklin's Small Steps book, right? He'd be like, here's the takeaway. I'm going to show you the game and I'm going to restate the takeaway. And I could go, Shanklin, I gotcha. Do I actually understand it? I don't know, but I read your bullet points. So that would be nice to have in this book. But then the other big one is there's no section on fortresses. And I don't know anything about fortresses. And I got to the end and I'm like, I know about end games. And then, you know, I was looking at Timeless Technique and they had a very short section on fortresses. And I'm like, oh, wait, there's this whole piece of end games. I don't have any idea what's going on. So I don't know if that was intentional or he just felt like it didn't fit into this style of book. And maybe that's too technical. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you can't cover everything. You did praise the length of it. So
yeah, exactly.
can't have it both ways. But yeah, fortresses, I mean, they're a pretty advanced concept. I mean, they might even be more advanced than most of the material in this book. So that might have something to do with it. But again, the updated version is going to have more material. So maybe fortresses will be in it. As for my least favorite, I mean, I really don't have a lot of gripes with this book. I mean, I do think, as with a lot of books, the earlier material in the book to me is the strongest. I don't know if there's some sort of fatigue that set in, but after the two bishops chapter, which is the third from the last, I thought that was very strong. But the 3-2 queen side pawn majority and complex endings, I felt like, as Kevin said, it's sort of the what's left over type mentality. So that's like a very minor quibble. I mean, overall, again, I love this book. The writing's beautiful. It's like, you know, I'm still in theory trying to get better at chess, but like, even if that were dead and buried, I wasn't working on my game, this is a book I would return to again and again for the writing and the classics alone.
Yeah, I think that last chapter, Complex Endings, he sells it as, this is going to be me putting all of these ideas together. And this would be the moment for him to kind of add the bullet points in, right? We talked about what he did. So here are these four things in practice. But instead, what he does is just like, here's another awesome game. Okay, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, and it's come up before on the book reviews. These older books, they often just kind of drop the mic and leave the room.
This ending is hilarious.
Yeah, yeah, they just no summary whatsoever. Yep. You know, so yeah, it's a common issue, and this one is no exception. I did want to read one quote before we get out of here. I think we're almost done here, Kevin. But just to give us a sense for the prose that I've been praising so much, so. Here's a quote about Smyslov Ronin game, another famous game. So they say, a mistake which shows how easily a certain win can slip away due to an incorrect valuation of an ensuing pawn ending. So a Ronin made a mistake. And then in a Ronin's defense, it has to be said that it was very difficult to see Smyslov's brilliant defensive idea. Besides, a player who is facing loss mobilizes all his strength and clutches at the slightest chance, however improbable, like a drowning man at a straw. The player who is winning, on the other hand, is reluctant to seek saving chances for his opponent, especially if they are of a very difficult nature. Even great players have been known to relax in such a situation, and chess history knows of numerous similar examples. So just very, very great evocative writing. And like there's a few where there's like not only an instructive end game, but like an important historical moment in the context of that end game. So, yeah, just very little bad to say about this book. And to be clear, sorry, that game ended in a draw, not a win. Sorry, go ahead, Kevin.
I was just going to say what a realistic quote that is. I do that all the time with ridiculous things. I'm like, oh, I've got an unstoppable mate in two. And they're like, really? What if I put my knight here? And they're like, okay. All right. I was a little too optimistic about my own.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. Like when it gets to my recent Master to IM episode where Evan Rosenberg was talking about how he'll commonly, when he's winning a game, he'll feel like, oh, this is over. So I'm, you know, I'm going to go get a burrito. then I'll have 3 out of 4.
I love that part of that episode. He's narrating the whole thing. And then his opponent's like, really? What if I do this?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, sorry. Go ahead, Kevin.
I was just going to say the last thing I would say is this. If you read the first chapter and you think this book does not represent what it says it is, like the first chapter is just poorly named, the basic principles of endgame play, because that's not what that first chapter is about. Don't let the first chapter scare you away. Read another chapter where there's actually a concept being talked about and go into it before you judge the book. Because I judged the book on the first chapter at least 4 times and put it down. Because I just was like, this isn't doing what it claims it's going to do. There aren't principles here.
Oh, that's interesting. Because my recollection, again, it's hazy, but of the first time I read it, I just like, it kind of rocked my world. I was just like, wow, you know, this is, you know, again, putting language into so many concepts that I was vaguely familiar with, but didn't necessarily have the words for, which made it a lot harder to sort of implement or recognize these ideas. So Kevin, like on a break, we were talking about, I always like to make a donation instead of actually paying you for your work, pay someone else, chess organization or something. And you were saying you'll leave it up to me.
Yeah, that sounds great. I realize I've listened to so many of these book recaps and I should have had that information on hand, but I do not.
Okay, well, we'll figure it out. There's plenty of worthy chess causes. Actually, this will come out before an interview with Elizabeth Shaughnessy of the Berkeley Chess School a few days before, but they're doing amazing work. I donated just because I was impressed with her, but maybe I'll make another donation to them. Shout out to Tunde, who we've been donating to a lot, but Tunde of Chess and Slums is taking over the world. Pretty soon he's going to be donating to us. So, although he deserves all the success he has, it's amazing to see. But yeah, for listeners who hadn't heard, like Paris Hilton somehow gave a shout out to the Chess and Slums organization. Chessable is going to be doing more work with them. So it's awesome to see. Tunde is an inspiring guy and it's a great story. And I'm sure we'll donate again in the future. Okay, so listeners, I'm not going to do a blindfold puzzle this time. Again, it's always a test to see how many people complain. So we'll see. Next month, we are going to do Under the Surface, one of my favorite modern chess books. I interviewed Grandmaster Jan Marcos about a year and a half ago. Very good interview if listeners haven't caught that one. He's a fascinating, like one of these guys who's clearly like on another level intellectually. But it's a classic book. I mean, especially I think amongst like the expert to master level sort of club player, it's beloved by anyone who's read it. Jan Marcos is a philosopher, so it's more philosophical in nature. So I'm going to be joined, hopefully, knock on wood, tentatively planned by Matt, Twitter, WMITTI on chess Twitter, stalwart, strong player, and National Master Gopal Menon, possibly the strongest NM in the world and font of chess information. So it should be a fun one. That's coming next month. But before we wrap up, Kevin, you got to give your most full-throated plug for the Chess Journeys podcast.
Okay. Can I start by giving a quick review of Under the Surface?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I read that book quickly, loved it, and I don't remember a single word of it. So
yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat. I've already read this one. I read it, you know, because I was interviewing him, and also it was like very high on my list of books I hadn't read because of people like Gopal and Matt praising it. Yeah, and it's similar. I'll definitely need to reread it before next month, but I'm looking forward to it. But yeah, it is. Yeah, you got to take notes as we were talking about.
Yeah,
before we recorded.
Kicking myself like it was brilliant, and I don't remember a word of it. Hopefully, it's rattling around somewhere.
Yeah, okay. And hopefully the podcast will help.
Hopefully. Yeah, hopefully it will. So Chess Journeys is a podcast that I started inspired by Perpetual Chess. The Adult Improver episodes were so amazing that I thought, what if we actually captured the stories of the people who are struggling? Ben does such a great job of capturing people sort of at their peak and talking about how they get to that peak. And I, you know, am kind of stuck at 1600 and have been for a bit. And I thought, what if I talk to people on all ranges, some people who are at their peaks, some people who are below their peaks by significant margins, some people who are just stuck. It's basically a weekly podcast episode where I ask people about their journeys, what's working for them, what's not working for them. Neil hosted the episode last time with me and he gave me some chess therapy. That was
Neil really Bruce. Helpful. Yeah, that was fun to listen to.
That was a good time. Yeah, my thought is just I'm hoping to provide a service for the community where people can come and hear stories that maybe mirror their own and provide them with some either glimmer of hope or some takeaways to help them on their own journeys, because we're all trying to get better and many of us are struggling.
Yeah, I always enjoy your very gently couched criticism of the super improver ethos, which I think is very fair. As I've mentioned in the past, as someone stuck at 2100 myself, certainly a plateau is the, like, as I mentioned to Neil, we were DMing. I enjoyed your intervention type interview with Neil, and I was just saying, like, a plateau is the norm. Like, I know it's frustrating, but that's the reality. And, you know, obviously I interview accomplished people, and actually you've inspired me to be less stringent. You know, I mainly want to make sure my guests are compelling, you know, more so than that they've had astronomic rating improvements. But yeah, definitely Chess Journeys is worth checking out if you guys enjoy hearing other people in the chess struggle. So thanks for pitching in, Kevin. We will link to the pod and your Twitter. And is there anything else we should link to?
So I do stream sometimes. It's not real often. I've resurrected my YouTube Dr. Skull a bit. I put my top 10 books from last year, which, you know, I read 18 books last year, or parts of them.
Are these all chess books? Or
yes, these are all chess books. And so I just kind of ranked what helped me the most. Remember, this is a 1600. And this is what helped me the most last year. And I'm, you know, doing some more stuff with that. So you can check out either of those if you want to see me a little bit more often. I will warn you, my stream is not exciting. I just go over annotated games slowly and carefully, and they take about an hour each. So you might be bored. Just a warning.
Yeah, I heard you talk about that in one of your pods where you're not looking to entertain people.
No, I'm doing chess improvement. And if you want to come improve with me, bring it on. If you come in and you're like, Kevin, this is the most boring thing I've ever heard, I will not dispute that.
Right. All right. I love it. All right. Well, thanks again, Kevin. Maybe when the new one comes out at some point, we can do like a 10-minute addendum and put it on another book recap because I'm eager to see what they come out with. And part of the reason I didn't buy a new one, I showed Kevin, mine is like vintage. I've had mine for 20 years or whatever. Is once I found out the new one was coming, I was like, well, I'm going to want that one. So let me just stick with my old book and then I'll get the new one when it comes out. So maybe we can do a quick update if you're up for it, Kevin.
Oh yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, thanks again, listeners. We will catch you all either next week or next month, depending on if you're listening to the interviews in between book recaps. Take care, everyone. Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, Benny Fischel 1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Podcast Network.